Yes, Lynn, question? Tricia, we've started. Yeah. That needs to be in the off position. Thank you. Yes, Lynn.
Who is generally credited with identifying these hermeneutical principles, and how and when?
Yeah, they've just developed over time. There's no one in particular. So observing how the Bible actually works and people writing it down, and then just, yeah, nobody in particular. Just there's a lot more than this, obviously. I'm just giving you the basic ones. Tricia had an interesting question during the break that I thought was worth examining. She asked me, and it probably comes up sometimes, people read Old Testament activities. There's a lot of immorality back there. You know, concubines and multiple wives. And the Bible, it can look like it's not condemning. It's actually condoning, sanctioning those activities. It's important to realize that the Bible records real events. But just because an event or an activity is recorded in Scripture doesn't mean that activity is being sanctioned. And actually, what the Old Testament does, and most of the Old Testament is narrative, and we're going to look at narrative here at the beginning, and the way narrative comments on morality is by showing consequences. So does the Bible condemn or condone these kind of activities? Well, it's never overtly very clear. But you have to understand the narrative genre and how narrative communicates. So what you find is all of the examples of multiple wives, immorality, concubines, always leads to pain, heartache, dysfunction, confusion, and problems. And so that's narrative's way of commenting on those activities, because it shows you what those activities produce, you see? As opposed to, we're used to maybe New Testament epistle genre that might say, don't have multiple wives. That's not how narrative communicates. So it's a little bit more difficult to understand what narrative's saying, but you look at the consequences. So every consequence produces pain and even cycles of dysfunction and pain. And so that's narrative's commentary on the morality of those kind of activities. God says, if you practice this, it will produce heartache, pain. That's why it's sin, because it hurts people. Does that make sense? Let's go to the special hermeneutics section now, and let's read this lengthy quote from the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy. They said, awareness of the literary categories of Scripture is essential for proper exegesis. The awareness of what kind of literature one is interpreting is essential to a correct understanding of the text. A correct genre judgment should be made to ensure correct understanding. A parable, for example, should not be treated like a chronicle, nor should poetry should be interpreted as though it were a narrative. Each passage has its own genre, and the interpreter should be cognizant of the specific kind of literature it is as he attempts to interpret it. Without genre recognition, an interpreter can be misled in his understanding of the passage. For example, when the prophet speaks of trees clapping their hands, one could assume a kind of animism unless he recognizes this is poetry and not prose. All right, the first genre that we'll look at is Old Testament narratives. Old Testament narratives. And 40% of the Old Testament is narrative. So it's by far the largest genre in Scripture, Old Testament narrative. And about 30% of the Bible is poetry. So the vast percentage of the Bible is poems and stories. That's mostly what it is. Now, a narrative is a story and not a full biography. It never tells us everything about the characters. We're used to reading literature from a totally different perspective. And so we need to understand how the Old Testament authors use the craft of narrative writing. Because in modern narrative, you get a lot of extra details that don't necessarily move the story along, but helped to place you in the story, to feel connection to the story, to feel like you can visualize and really see what's going on. So you might get a paragraph or a page, or even in some of the writings, a whole chapter describing the physical characteristics of a particular character. My daughter talked me into reading Les Miserables a couple years ago because at 22 she'd read it 5 times. So I felt she shamed me into reading it. And so when I dove into it, and not the abridged version, because the original version is like 1,100 pages or something, and there's just a whole chapter that's just a description of a person's face or their physical characteristics. And, I mean, it's brilliant prose and well-written, but, boy, it is really loaded with detail. Now, this is the opposite of Old Testament narrative. You see, most of that in Hugo's work could be eliminated, and you wouldn't even know it. It doesn't add to move the story along. It's not ultimately necessary. And we're just used to that. But Old Testament narrative is not like that. See, every bit, every detail is necessary to your understanding. So you don't get all the details that you want, but every detail has a purpose. Every detail has a purpose. And if a detail has been omitted, there's a purpose for that. Not only does everything that is actually listed have a purpose, but when the author left out things that seemed like it was important for you to know, there's a reason for that. So you're not only asking the question continually, why am I being told this? Why do I need this information? But you're also asking the question, what would I have expected them to tell me? What does it seem logical that I should know that I don't know? And why has the author chosen not to tell me that? Because there's insight available in those questions. Now let's go into some more of the details. There are 3 elements to look for in narrative: plot, character, and dialogue. And I think you know what most of these mean, but let's just make sure. Plot, number 1, point 3, I guess, is the arrangement of the incidences that make up the story. So plot is generally, this is the things that happen that make up the basic narrative. And there are 3 elements. First of all is the background, which introduces the story and identifies the character, their relationships, and position in life. We'll talk more about that. And then the conflict is the struggle the main character encounters. And conflict is essential to a story. If you don't have conflict, you don't have a story. For example, to say Little Red Riding Hood brought a basket of goodies to her grandmother is not a story. When does the story begin? When the wolf shows up. Now we have a story. See, now we have conflict. So without conflict, we don't have a story. As soon as we have conflict, now we have a story. And conflict can be both internal and external. There's external conflict against people. And it's always conflict versus people. Conflict in secular fiction, oftentimes conflict is man versus nature. So, for example, in the writings of Jack London, famous American author, wrote White Fang, Call of the Wild, to Build a Fire. The movie that's out now, but Liam Neeson, The Gray, is in sort of the Jack London kind of tradition. It's man against nature. But there's never that conflict in Scripture. Scripture's about human relationships. So the conflict, the external conflict, is always people versus people, a person versus a person. There's a conflict. That's the external. But then there's internal conflict, too. So, for example, in the Joseph narrative, there's multiple conflict. Some of the external conflict in the Joseph narrative would be what? Give me some examples. Brothers. Those brothers, yeah, that's one. Good, yeah. Another one. Potiphar's wife, yeah. There's a major conflict there. Another one.
Baker and the cupbearer.
Yeah, Baker and the cupbearer. So we have external, but then there's also internal conflict that Joseph has experienced. So it's Joseph versus temptation. There's an internal conflict, a temptation to hate his brothers. They sure gave him every opportunity and every reason to hate. That's an internal struggle that Joseph's experiencing. Why shouldn't I just lash out and hate and take my revenge? There's an internal conflict towards the temptation to lie with Potiphar's wife. That's internal, that he's experiencing it. Or probably the greatest one is just to forget God's promises. He's 17 when the promises come, he's 30. So 13 years. No fulfillment. It looks like just the opposite. And not just 13 years, but 17 to 30. I mean, those are prime years of a person's life, seemingly lost. There's a tremendous internal pressure, you see. And unless you understand what the conflict is, you're not going to get the point of the narrative. So the external conflict is usually pretty easy to discover. The internal conflict takes a little bit more probing. But that's usually where the depth of insight and understanding comes. What's the internal conflict that's happening with our character? Background conflict, and then the resolution. The resolution, or the literary term is the denouement, when all of the events of the story that have been unraveled get put back together. The resolutions, the conclusion of the story, the main issues are settled. So in Joseph's story, it's the final fulfillment of Joseph's dream when his brothers are bowing down before him. The main issues are settled in the subsequent relocation to Egypt. Now, let's talk a little bit more about background narration. Background narration is supplemental information. Supplemental information that provides clues to the meaning of the story. It does not move the story along, but provides explanatory and contextual information to help us understand the story. So background narration usually introduces a new story. That's how we know one chapter, one vignette has ended and a new one has begun. It introduces a new story. It covers principal characters, important geography, habitual behavior, but it primarily introduces significant relationships. Because the Bible is primarily about relationships. And so when you're looking at the introduction, the background narration, the introduction to a character, to a new story, to a new phase of the plot, if you will, then you're examining this information to find out what key relationships, what are we learning about the key relationships that is the key to understanding why this story has been included in Scripture. So, for example, the beginning of the narrative concerning Samuel starts, there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophaim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zoph, Ephrathite. I practiced. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, what do we learn in this brief background? What do we find out? What are some of the information we get? Yeah, we learn about his tribe. Yeah, and we learn about his hometown. Now, actually, that's going to be significant later in the story. Mark that down. That's going to help you understand something later in the story. You didn't just get that because it's kind of to add color. It's crucial to something you need to know later on. What else do we find out? Yeah, the most important information. This dude, his two wives. And what's the most important information we get? Hannah is barren, but Peninnah is not. So this, out of everything that we could be told, and certainly think about all the things that we could have been told that we would have been interested in hearing, the only thing that's important for us to know is these relationships right here. Hannah and Peninnah and their relationship to Elkanah. So the Bible is about relationships, you see. And characters make choices in the context of their relationships with other people. And that gives us the meaning of the narrative. So other pieces of background narration emerge at significant times during the plot. The Hebrew writers do not give you all the background information up front. Now, here's another interesting thing and different than most normal fiction. In normal fiction, they give you the description of the character and the background information when they first introduce the character, and then they go on to plot elements. But the Hebrew narrators tell you information up front, but sometimes they withhold background information until significant times in the story. And when you get new background information, you ask yourself, why am I learning this now? It's just background information, but why now? Why not in the beginning when it was introduced? So, for example, 1 Samuel chapter 17, and when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. Now, here's some new information about David. We find out he's got red hair. He's ruddy, so his complexion is, he's got freckles and red hair, which would stand out. I mean, it would stand out in the Philippines, wouldn't it? It would certainly stand out in ancient Israel. And not only, but he's handsome in appearance. He's a good-looking fella. Now, why do we learn this at this point of the story? This is background information. I mean, this is right in the middle of the battle. It seems like you should find this out before the battle scene. Because, of course, our thought process is the action is the crucial stuff. But in Hebrew narrative, it's the dialogue. It's not the action. We'll learn about this. Why are we getting this piece of information? David's red hair and handsome appearance are not mentioned until Goliath lays eyes on him in the middle of the battlefield. What does that do? You see, that adds to the drama of the scene. And when we look at Goliath actually calls out to him, we could give a loose paraphrase, okay, and it's very loose. But in essence, what Goliath says as he sees David for the first time, essentially in kind of modern day jargon, he says, it's a boy and a red-headed pretty boy at that. So there is a disdain, you see, right in the middle of the battle, which is sent to underscore the conflict here. And what it does, it puts in sharp contrast the two separate covenants that are being represented. Because the covenant is one of the main themes. That's why you see David, it looks like it's just trash talk. It looks like he's just insulting uncircumcised Philistine. You know, that seems like the kind of language that soldiers would use in the middle of battle. And yet it's a reference to covenant. David said, I come to you. So you're uncircumcised. It means you have no covenant. You represent only yourself. But I come representing the God of heaven. I come in his covenant, you see. And so even though we look here, it's sort of a reversal. When you look at the scene, here's this tiny little, cute little redhead mama's boy looking fella. And here's this massive warrior. And yet the little cute boy is the one, he knows he's got something this big fella doesn't have. So it throws in sharp contrast. The real point of the story is the power of God's covenant to accomplish his purpose. See, so we're looking for these kinds of details and asking, why did I just find that out now? You stop and pause and wonder and bombard the text with questions. Why didn't I find this out earlier? Why does this even matter at this point? Does that make sense to you? See, it's a lot more work reading Old Testament narrative. And I think you're going to find it a lot more fun. You're going to want to go back and read some of these stories from a new grid, asking a lot of questions, and there's a lot more things that you didn't realize was there. Okay, another thought. Excessive background narration always signifies something of importance. Signifies something. Okay, so because Old Testament narration is very terse, succinct, to the point, as opposed to a more flamboyant modern style, when an author gives you more details than normal, you have to ask the question, why? This is a break with the normal description. So, for example, 1 Samuel 17, and there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, over 9 feet. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went with him. Now, you got to ask the question, why does the author give us so much detail about Goliath's armor? This is so unlike Hebrew narrative. Again, I'll let you think about the answer to that question, but those are the questions you have to ask. We got way more detail than we're used to getting. Why? Why? Number 5. Narrative has a central character called the protagonist. Protagonist. Do you remember this from basic English class or literature classes? Protagonist. And then a character that opposes the central character called the antagonist. And usually minor characters that contrast or parallel the central characters. These are called foils. So you got a protagonist, antagonist, and then foils. Now, in a larger narrative, you usually have multiple antagonists and then multiple foils. So the question you have to ask yourself is, in each story, what role is that character playing? Is this the antagonist, the protagonist, or a foil? So, for example, in the Joseph narrative, in reference to Potiphar's wife, what role does Potiphar's wife play in the narrative? Antagonist? Certainly that's her primary role, but she's also a foil. You see, a foil is a character often presented as a stereotype, so not fully developed, that contrasts something, a characteristic, in the primary character, the protagonist. So not only she's the obvious antagonist, but really she's much more of a foil. She's kind of a stereotype. And what is she supposed to contrast with our protagonist, Joseph, here? That's the thing we have to ask ourselves. So as we begin looking at that, we see the one thing that's pretty obvious with her. She's got a very cavalier attitude towards her covenantal obligation to her husband, right? Just whatever, he's not around, you're good looking, let's give him something to talk about, right? That's her attitude. Now, what does that contrast? Huh? What is the dominant characteristic we see about Joseph in this whole situation? Huh? Loyalty to his covenant. That's why his response is not, I'm going to get caught. We will be found out. I'll get in trouble. But his response is, how could I do this thing and sin against God? So what we see, her purpose is to show, is to throw in stark contrast her just very relaxed and casual attitude about covenantal obligations with the fierce covenant loyalty that Joseph shows. So look at the particular characters that step in to the story and ask yourself, what are they, by their behavior, what are they reflecting? What am I supposed to understand about the protagonist? Does that make sense to you? The protagonist's choices and actions give us insight into his or her character. Therefore, the main object lessons of the narrative come from the protagonist's response to the crisis he or she encounters. See, Old Testament narrative is not like Aesop's fables. We don't get the moral of the story at the end. The narrator rarely tells us what we're supposed to learn from the story. It's our job to analyze the choices that are made and the consequences that come from the protagonist. And that's where the lessons are discovered and found. Now, in the Old Testament narrative, there is usually more dialogue than action. People are portrayed by dialogue, not by description of the narrator. Therefore, dialogue provides insight into their character. So let's examine some principles about dialogue. Number one, the action in a passage is carried mainly by dialogue in the Old Testament literature. Now, see, this is the opposite of an action movie, okay? In an action movie, we pay our money for action. Now, all we want is witty lines during the battle scenes that provide a little comic relief, right? We don't want detailed discussions, philosophical musings on the events that are transpiring. Just action with occasional comments that make us laugh during the midst of the real action. That's not what we get in the Bible. Old Testament narrative. The real action is carried by the dialogue. So, for example, probably the most dynamic action scene in all of Scripture is David and Goliath and their conflict, right? But when we look at that passage, in that battle scene, there is a total of the number of words involved. 143 of the words are narrative, action. 157 is dialogue. So, I mean, here's the main action scene that preachers love to expand upon, right? Add all sorts of vivid details. But to be faithful to the text, it's really about two dudes talking, mostly. Most of the action is carried on by the dialogue and not by the narration of the author. So let's look at a few principles related to dialogue. principle number one, direct speech is the primary method for revealing character and motivation. The author's assumption is that what is significant about a character can be displayed almost entirely in the character's speech. So when you're reading most fiction, you learn about the character because the third person omniscient narrator tells you what he's thinking. You're told what to think about this person. You don't get that in Old Testament narrative. All you get is this person's dialogue. Now it's your job, it's our job, to figure out what does this reveal about this person. Because rarely is the text going to tell us what we're supposed to think about that. Let's give an example here. First time we meet Saul. Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us go back, lest my father cease to care about the donkeys and become anxious about me." But he, this is the servant, said to him, "Behold, there is a man of God in this city, and he is a man who's held in honor. All that he says comes true. So now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us the way we should go." Then Saul said to his servant, "But if we go, what can we bring the man? For the bread in our sacks is gone, and there's no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" The servant answered Saul again, "Here I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way." And Saul said to the servant, "Well said, come, let us go." Now ask yourself the question, what do we learn about Saul's character in this passage? By the way, these are Saul's first words in Scripture. And the first words a character speaks is usually significant to give us great insight into their character, destiny, purpose, etc. What do we see about the character of Saul in his response in this section, in his dialogue? Anyone have any thoughts? Pinky, what do you see? You get anything? What kind of feel do you get about this character Saul just through his dialogue? Pinky, you get anything? Sense of responsibility. Other people, yeah, Cricket? Considerate? What, Karen? Okay, how do you see that? Yeah. Yeah, okay. Lynn? Cautious to a fault. Yeah, not what maybe looks like responsibility in the first reading actually is just uncertainty. I mean, that's what shows up the whole time. Okay, well, we're supposed to, this is our job we're supposed to accomplish, but it's not working. Let's turn back. Turn back? Really? Turn back. And then, but then it's the servant who doesn't even have a name. He's the real leader in the group. Well, no, there's a man of God here. And his first thought is, yeah, but we don't have anything to give him. We'll be embarrassed in front of him. You see, he's concerned about how he's going to look in the eyes of other people. See? Now, you can go through it and you begin looking and digging deeper and deeper. And we get insights into his character. And we see this plays out throughout his whole life. This is the essence of who he is, and it's revealed by his dialogue the first time that we see him. He's a man uncertain about which way to go. He's a man influenced by the words of others, and a man deeply concerned about what others think about him. And this is going to be his bane. It's going to be his downfall. Yeah. It's a challenging process. It takes some work to actually get it right. So there'll be a lot of misfires and missteps before you can begin to get some of the insights. Now, another thought or a subpoint here. Expected dialogue left unsaid is a key for revealing character and motivation. Expected dialogue left unsaid is a key for revealing character and motivation. Now, this is a real long passage, but I want you to, as I'm reading it, I want you to be asking yourself, what is unsaid? What would you expect? What would you have said? What do you think that the person in this story, someone should have said? What is surprising that it's not been said? Be asking yourself and see that question and see if you can come up with it. Now, this man, this is Elkanah, used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. So what do you think? What dialogue would you have expected is not said? Krish? Say it again.
Hannah's response to Elkanah.
There's a pretty obvious one, okay? He asked three questions. Why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Oh, four questions. Why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? Elkanah thought real highly of himself, pretty obviously. Now, you get four questions and no answer. Now, that ought to tip you off. Why? Now, women here, okay? Married women. This is weird, right? That she doesn't respond? Can you imagine? Why wouldn't she respond? What's the literary technique that the author is using? What is he trying to communicate? There's one other major incident here that there's dialogue left unsaid. What is it? Yeah, Peninnah and Hannah. This woman is provoking her year after year. Come on, ladies. You got a rival who's provoking constantly, and there's no response. Why? 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 Jing, why? Why is there no response? Why? Maybe out of jealousy, okay? That's a possibility. Carol, what do you think? Don't worry, just talk. She's what? Kept what? Bitterness in her heart, okay? It's a possibility. Charles, what do you think? Doesn't value herself that much? Maybe? Just thought? Yeah, Yvette? That's exactly right. The first time we hear her speak, she never speaks until the first time she talks to God. Now that's a literary device, you see. And what it tells us is that Hannah realized this is not between me and Peninnah. This is not about me and Elkanah. This is about me and God. There's something here. And I can respond to humans, but God's at work here. There's something. That's why twice we're told the Lord closed her womb. Hannah realized. And so it's as much as she was tempted to lash out, she knew it's not the real problem. It's not the source. There's something that God's up to. There's something about this situation. And I have to go beyond just the secondary incidences and see God in this terrible, painful, agonizing situation. What are you doing? What's this about? Why is this happening? You see, the phrase that adds the real poetic drama to this passage is this little sentence, so it went on year by year. So you got to stop and pause when you see things like that and just absorb that year by year. This is not just one little statement. We're told here in the narrative that Peninnah, that Elkanah gave portions not unto Peninnah, but to all her sons and daughters. So that sons and daughters are both plural. That means there's at least four children, minimum. But when we look at infant mortality rate, who knows how many pregnancies is involved in here and how many years. And each child is another provocation. Each child is another announcement of pregnancy, is another arrow in her heart. And yet she never responds, but she keeps her focus constantly on God through every situation and every bad situation, treated wrongly, unfairly, not understood. So that's what you should get from the, when you look at Elkanah. It's obviously, dude, you don't get your wife here. Okay? There's some courses you need to take. But I mean, to say, look, aren't I enough? You just do not grasp the situation. You don't get it. She's not, there's nobody that understands her. But year after year, with no one to confide in, no one to talk to, she has to keep enduring. And the whole time, she keeps entrusting herself to God. Now, that's some powerful stuff, you see. All from dialogue left unsaid. We get that because of what's not said, as well as what is said. All right? Principle number two. You doing okay? Am I overloading you? Probably, but too bad. That's why we have podcasts. So you can go back, podcasts and notes. I'm just going to say what I got to say. Okay, principle number two. And we've mentioned this already. The first time a character speaks is often revelatory and the key to understanding the text. Now, I didn't believe this the first time I read this, that this was true. But I did a search through Old Testament narrative, and it's remarkably accurate. Not every situation, but almost every situation I looked at, the first time a character speaks, we get some significant insight about that character that carries through throughout their whole destiny in life. It's a fascinating thing. So 1 Samuel chapter 17. It's interesting, we're first introduced to David in 1 Samuel chapter 16. The whole chapter is about him. And then we learn more about him in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Really, the whole chapter is about him also. And yet, he never speaks until this passage. Another thing to look at that's pretty interesting, if you go and you look at chapter 16, seven times God speaks in chapter 16. And David doesn't speak once. In chapter 17, David speaks seven times, and God never speaks. Why? I'll let you figure it out. Here's the first time he speaks. See, these are all literary devices. There's insight in those things. David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God. Now, what did David's first words communicate to us? What do we learn from this? Gans, what do you think? What do we get? First time he speaks, what feeling do you get from those words? What does that conjure up? Okay. Yeah, that's a good insight, I think. But when you look at the first phrase of the first sentence, it leads you towards a mercenary kind of self-centered approach. But you see, because it's not the end of the sentence, there's a conjunction there, and so takes away the reproach from Israel. So the primary motivation of his heart is revealed in his very first sentence. He's concerned not just about the covenant people of God, but the living God. And the reproach of God's people is a reproach to who? To Jehovah. And so what we see about David, and this is the great contrast between him and Saul, is that despite all of his failings, because the reality is David actually sins more quantitatively and qualitatively than Saul does. And yet, one thing that stands out all the way through the narrative, and it's seen in the beginning, is his passion is for the honor and glory of God. And despite all of his many failings, what always comes out at the end is God's honor and God's glory. And that's why he's a man after God's own heart. And so from the very beginning, a young boy, yeah, there's some mixed motivation in there. So, you know, he's looking for some benefit. But the primary thing that stands out is for the glory and honor of God. I'm going to see if I can get this last principle in here before we break. Principle number 3, contrastive dialogue. Contrastive, contrastive, is one of the primary ways the Bible reveals character. Character differentiation is brought out chiefly through contrast. So here's an example. After a time, this is Joseph and Potiphar's wife. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house. And he's put everything that he has in my charge. He's not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Now, there's a great contrast there. And you have to look, the contrast is more even in what they say, but in the quantity. Notice Potiphar's words are direct, raw passion. Three words in the English. Actually, in the original Hebrew, it's just two words. And somewhat, I mean, it's hard to translate them because it sounds a little risque. But it would be something like, "Take me." Or even something even a little bit more sensual than that. So, as a matter of fact, the only words that she ever speaks to Joseph are those words, and she does it twice. That's her only dialogue. Out of all the interaction, the only thing is just two times, "Take me now." So it's just pure, raw passion. But when we look at Joseph's speech, what are the feeling that we get? Now listen to this, "Behold." So who starts with "behold," right? It's this lengthy statement. She's got two words. Joseph, there's 62. Hers are pure, raw passion. His are reasoned, logical. It's like a lawyer. So what we have to understand is it's not that, I mean, it's not that he's experiencing some kind of real temptation, okay? I mean, he's not dead. She's a beautiful woman, and she is skilled in the arts of seduction. And, I mean, he's a teenager, okay? All of the various physiological reactions are taking place, and yet his speech is like, it's like a lawyer's presentation, setting forth the facts, very reasoned and logical. You see, what we see is that even though there's real, obviously, emotions, he has allowed scriptural truth to take control of his passion and to control him rather than to be controlled by his passions. So that's what we see in the dialogue. We see more about his character. In contrast to her, she's just given to her passions. And he, having real emotions, like a real normal red-blooded young boy, and yet he's allowed scripture and truth to control them.